This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Morning, friends. Today we have with us Cole Martin, a journalist who is based on the occupied West Bank of Palestine, and we'll be talking about the conflict in Gaza and Palestine and the future of Palestine. You can podcast this by going to orfm.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to community or chaos. Good morning, Cole.
Good morning, Marvin. Lovely to join you. Thanks for having me.
Briefly, can you tell us why you became a journalist?
And what I kind of when I first finished high school, I worked for World Vision for a couple of years doing the kind of 40-hour famine and traveled over to Uganda with them and then was sharing those stories around high schools and churches around Aotearoa. And it really, I think seeing the power of photo and video to really connect people to these stories and mobilize people, just really kind of lit something in me for actually this is a really powerful way to embody social change and meaningful difference in people's lives. So went and studied that at New Zealand Broadcasting School, and then ended up doing exactly that in the West Bank of Palestine.
Why did you decide to go to the West Bank? It's not the safest place in the world to live.
Yeah. So I actually first visited the West Bank around 6 years ago in 2019. I had actually just been volunteering with Syrian refugee communities in northern Jordan for a month. And being a Kiwi on the other side of the world, I thought, well, you know, where else can I go while I'm over here? And so I spent 3 weeks around Palestine, Israel. And yeah, what I saw meeting there with communities, particularly in Hebron City, and Tent of Nations, which is a Palestinian Christian farm just outside of Bethlehem, really shocked me. Like it was some, I was like, this is really messed up. There's some really dark and heavy and wrong things going on here. And recognizing the involvement of the international community and my own faith community of Christians, often in really harmful ways globally, really engaged me in wanting to share those stories, and particularly the contextual kind of background that often gets kind of skipped over or missed in media. And so then last year, me and a few friends went over to Bethlehem to a conference there at the Bible College, and I stayed for another month, which then became 2 months, kind of documenting what was going on, and those connections kind of kept building. And so this year I got a grant from the Quakers here in Aotearoa, and to go back and continue doing more journalism and to study Arabic in order to do better journalism. So that's how I kind of found myself over there this year for 6 months, living and reporting from the West Bank as far as I know, the only or one of the only New Zealand journalists on the ground during this period.
You think you'll be able to go back if you choose to?
I certainly hope so. I've formed many close relationships and friendships with people there, and it is difficult being far away from all of that while all of the struggle and suffering that they face continues. And just really lovely people. Often the headlines kind of skip over the depth of generosity and hospitality and kindness that I was just experienced from all of the Palestinian communities I met there. I certainly hope I can get back, but it is the toss up as well as, you know, I want to be there. I want to be with my friends, but what kind of friend would I be if I wasn't also doing all that I could to share about the struggles that communities there are facing? And the reality is, in sharing those, it does risk visa and ability to re-enter.
One of the things that you can learn by taking part in some of the walks and marches for Palestinians in New Zealand is you can learn about their hospitality and warmth and their caring by participating.
Yeah, there's some wonderful Palestinians in our community here in Aotearoa who, it's very special. And it's a really great way of understanding what's going on there as well, because their loved ones are still on the ground continuing to face this stuff.
Can you give us a very brief synopsis of Palestinians' history from the end of World War II into the present?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of the important context happens even slightly before World War II, with
sure.
the signing of things like the Balfour Declaration,
okay,
which was
yeah.
kind of, and some of the kind of early kind of church ideology, which came around in the early 1800s, which again fueled this foreign policy in Britain and a lot of the rest of Europe. Of this kind of political movement called Zionism, which basically said, it basically kind of led to the establishment of an explicitly Jewish state within the land of Palestine. And so following World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust, and grappling with how to respond to European anti-Semitism that had fueled the Holocaust, a lot of nations, when the League of Nations was formed, or what then became the United Nations, they voted for what they called the partition plan, to divide the land of Palestine up into two states, one a Jewish state and one a Palestinian state, ignoring the fact that, you know, these groups and these religious faith communities had lived in and amongst and alongside each other for millennia. And so many of those living on the ground rejected that plan, but the many Zionists and Jewish communities fleeing the horrors of the Holocaust had come into the land, and this idea of a Jewish-only state kind of gained momentum. And so in 1948, the Nakba happened, which was in Arabic means catastrophe, because the establishment of Israel wasn't just kind of, oh, here's a state, but it actually came with the forced expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians, who were ethnically cleansed from over 530 villages, which still remain today in rubble or ruins, in Israeli kind of national parks and nature reserves. 15,000 people were killed, and in a series of over 100 massacres. And so many of those communities still today live in refugee camps in Gaza and the West Bank and around the region, and a number of them also elsewhere in the world, including here in New Zealand. And so, yeah, that's kind of the establishment of Israel kind of began this knock-on effect, which has continued in the occupation of Palestinian land and areas. And what Palestinians describe as settler colonialism. It's very similar style and manner of displacement of these indigenous communities from the land, as similar to here in Aotearoa. And it continues today in the West Bank and Gaza, which in 1967 came under Israeli occupation. So the entire land essentially is under Israeli control. There's various pockets of Palestinian autonomy, but a lot of the time it's very symbolic at best. And the expansion of these Israeli communities, these settlements within the West Bank, continues day after day after day. And so in response to decades of this violence and structural violence and systems of domination, various forms of resistance have come around. And many of those are creative nonviolence or civil disobedience. And a number of those as well have erred into armed resistance with the likes of groups that people have heard of, like Hamas in Gaza and such.
Can you describe life on the West Bank and talk about some of your experiences and the people you've met?
So the West Bank, for those who are unfamiliar with the geography, Gaza is kind of it's a little strip out on the coast, and it is geographically separate from the West Bank, which runs on the western bank of the Jordan River, so kind of to the east, and they are split in the middle by the modern state of Israel. So the West Bank unlike Gaza, is not under the same kind of crippling siege or blockade that Israel has had Gaza under for decades now, but it is. It's in a kind of lesser way. The West Bank has what Israelis call a security barrier running around it to prevent Palestinians from moving freely from that land. But 85% of it's actually built inside the West Bank. And so it's kind of been used as de facto annexation of large swathes of Palestinian farmland and such. So where I was living in Bethlehem, which is kind of just south of the centre of the West Bank, the birthplace of Jesus, many people will know it as. And I was living there in Ida Camp, which is one of almost 60 refugee camps across the region that have been established for these families and communities who were displaced by Israel's establishment. And so almost eight decades on, it doesn't look like a traditional kind of tent city refugee camp, as we often think they look like. It's more of a kind of city suburb, very tall concrete buildings, very narrow streets, and very limited infrastructure because it hasn't been able to develop like a normal city suburb would. And in the case of Ida Camp, it's actually a 2017 study found it's the most tear gassed place in the world because they constantly face Israeli military raids at nighttime. Once or twice a week, the military will come in, raid people's homes, abduct people from their bedrooms, fire off live rounds, tear gas, rubber bullets. And so, yeah, the communities who live there are incredibly resilient, as I say, incredibly kind and generous in their hospitality, but their life is a real struggle. The rooftops of every house there have water tanks on them to store the water, because even in the West Bank, the quote Palestinian area, Israel controls all of the water supplies. And so 80% of it is funneled off to Israeli civilians. Meanwhile, only 20% of it is left for Palestinian communities. And in the likes of Ida Camp, it will sometimes be a week or 2 weeks that they won't have any water coming through the pipes. For one period while I was there, it was 2 months that we had no water coming through the pipes. And so when you're out and you have to go and collect it from somewhere nearby if someone else has water. So that's a bit of insight into the refugee camps, particularly Ida, where I was living for the last 6 months. But then, yeah, I also spent a lot of time with some of the more rural communities down south in areas like Masafer Yatta, a collection of around 20 rural farming areas, villages that have these illegal Israeli settlements placed all around them. So these settlements, when we say settlements, these are townships specifically built exclusively for Jewish Israelis. And they're often built on what was formerly Palestinian farmland, which has either been taken through dubious legal dealings, like the Wastelands Law, where if land hasn't been farmed for 3 years, it becomes state-owned land, or through the violent expulsion of Palestinian communities on that land. And so Masafer Yatta are kind of on the front lines of this settlement expansion. These villages constantly face, like every day, settlers coming in, raiding their village, harassing them, vandalizing their property, attacking them. I even had a friend of mine, Alda Hathaline, was shot dead this year by a settler in broad daylight on camera. But when the military arrived to sort things out, they, instead of arresting the settler who was caught on camera, they instead arrested 22 of Alda's family members and took them off to prison for days where they faced beatings and humiliation. Meanwhile, his killer was released to home detention in less than 24 hours, cleared of all charges within 5 days, and back terrorizing the village within a week. And the family, you know, weren't even able to bury Alda's body until 10 days later because Israel refused to return it. They stole the body, which is a long-standing practice. You know, Israel still hold bodies from the 90s, the 80s even, and earlier of Palestinians. And so it was actually only when 60 of the village's women went on hunger strike calling for the release of Alda's body that it was released. This is, you know, Alda's sister, his mum, his wife, literally starving themselves just in order to bury their loved one. And so finally, Alda's body was returned 10 days later and they held a funeral, but many people were barred from being able to attend the funeral. The military set up these checkpoints to restrict access and the terrorism of their village has continued now with the creation of an outpost, a small settlement right in the middle of their village, which now splits it in half and cuts off water and electricity and soon road access to over 100 residents in the southern half of that village. So that's like one example, but this is happening all across the West Bank. You know, there's an average of 8 settler attacks a day. These house demolitions are taking place almost daily as well. and it just continues. I think there's been over a dozen villages this year alone just in the Jordan Valley completely displaced and erased by Israeli settler violence and military action. So it's life is incredibly hard there. And people, you know, they're resilient and they remain, but they remain there because it's their home. They remain there by necessity. But if you could kind of just cease to exist out of despair, I think a lot of these communities, you know, they would. They're humans. So it is hard. Yeah.
You described the first village you stayed at, them getting raided two or three times a week at night. That happen all the time? Why do those raids happen?
Yeah, so are you talking the refugee camp that I mentioned earlier?
Yes.
Yeah, so a lot of the refugee camps, because these communities have been waiting for the right to return to their villages, which in what is now Israel, for almost 8 decades now, these camps are often the kind of epicenter of where these civil disobedience and resistance movements kind of grow from, because these are the communities facing probably the most injustice. And so in response to these, you know, movements, Israel have often targeted the refugee camps, and that includes in Gaza. You know, 80% of Gaza are refugees who were expelled from what is now Israel during the creation of Israel. And so, you know, that this is the context behind this kind of widespread denial or lack of recognition of the Israeli state. You know, it's not because it's a Jewish state, it's because it's an exclusively Jewish state. It's because it was built on the homes, in the homes, on the bones, and with the stolen wealth of these generations of Palestinian families. And so, yeah, basically, until that is addressed, until these communities have either the right to return to their land or, you know, proper reparations for the trauma that they've faced, these movements will always keep existing. And so, yeah, that's why you see a lot of these military action in the camps, arresting people for so much as throwing a stone. That's the most common charge. People can be held for, I think, up to 10 or 20 years for throwing stones. And that can include people as young as 12 now, I believe. It was 14. I think it's just been lowered to 12. And all of these people, when they're taken away by Israeli military, they get charged in military courts, not civil courts, which are two very different legal systems. And Israel's the only country in the world that will actually charge children, so people under the age of 18, in these military courts. They're currently holding over 400 children. And I was fortunate to visit Ofer military courts last year with Military Court Watch, who do write reports specifically on children being put through the military court system. And I met Lulu Nasser, whose daughter Layan is 25 years old. She's a Palestinian Christian and an Anglican like me. And she was abducted from her home last year in April at about 4 a.m. There was a loud knocking on the door. They opened it and found a dozen heavily armed soldiers pointing their guns in Lulu's face, who said, "Be quiet or we'll shoot. We're at war. We can do whatever we like." And so they took her and her husband through to the lounge at gunpoint, and then went through to Leanne's room, where they zip-tied her hands together, blindfolded her, and took her away. And she was held for 8 months last year in a system called administrative detention, where Palestinians are held without charge, without trial, in prison conditions that have been referred to by Israel's own leading human rights organization as torture camps, you know, well-documented physical, sexual, and psychological abuse, starvation as well. There's over 3,500 other Palestinians currently held with no charge, no trial, in Israeli captivity, facing these conditions. So it raises this really jarring kind of double standard or juxtaposition when our elected leaders and others within society rightly call for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza, but for decades have ignored Palestinians being held in exactly the same manner.
I read in The Guardian about a prisoner who'd been tortured, and a military commander was arrested for bringing that to the military court and making it public.
Mm.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so that was just recently. I think it was earlier this year or late last year, video footage came out of soldiers who were using their kind of riot shields to shield the view by security cameras in this prison as they raped a Palestinian detainee. And there have been, you know, well-documented reports of this for decades, for many years, long before October 2023. But particularly over the last years, it has really, the violence and torture in these prisons has really deteriorated. And so this video footage is chilling. And it highlighted this to a lot of the world. And the person who actually leaked this video footage is one of Israel's top military lawyers. And it, again, raises this just bizarre circumstance that people were outraged, not because of this horrific crime of torturing and raping a prisoner, but they were outraged that this military lawyer leaked the footage. And that's become what the focus is about within Israel. You know, these huge protests calling for the release of the soldiers who committed this crime, and calling for the imprisonment and punishment of the lawyer who leaked this footage. People aren't addressing the fact that this is widespread within Israeli prisons. It's incredibly disturbing. And again, this is all information that's out there, very easy to find on public records. Often it's actually Israel's own media will very openly cover it, but it becomes an issue when international media cover it, because that's where the power sits. That's where the change needs to happen, is international countries actually holding Israel to account for these systems and structures which are de facto policy.
For people living on the West Bank, particularly children, is normal life at all possible? Do they attend schools and things like that?
Yeah. Normal. It's strange how to characterize normal, because life does go on fairly normal in many places. But normal for them is not normal for us. You know, constantly, if you're moving between cities, you have to go through checkpoints that can be closed off at any stage. So your, you know, 20-minute journey could become a 3 to 6 hour journey. Kids going to schools, like, yes, there's access to schooling, but even this year we've seen, well, over many years, we've seen a real crackdown on particularly schools run by UNRWA, which have been closed this year. Many people now don't have access to school. And, you know, I was studying at Bethlehem University as well. It's a beautiful, bustling university. Young people, it's very lively. It's like any university campus in the world, but just under the surface for everyone is Gaza. You know, it's present in every conversation, but often never mentioned. It's just this real heaviness. And so all these facets of occupation, the checkpoints, the wall, the military raids, they're always there. You know, people stay up all through the night, listening, waiting to see, you know, will the military come tonight? Not that they can prevent anything, but at least, you know, mothers can wake up their children ahead of time to stop it from being quite as traumatic to suddenly wake and find soldiers in your house. So normal, what has become normal in the West Bank is certainly abnormal. But yeah, in many ways, you know, life continues as normally as it can. People persist. People, humans have this wonderful ability to adapt to our circumstances, but these are circumstances that no one should have to adapt to.
Have you come across the community peace teams, formerly known as Christian peace teams?
Yes, yeah, I met some of them there. They're still working on the ground doing some really fantastic work, particularly, again, with these rural communities who are on the front lines of settler violence and house demolitions. They'll go in there and interview them and collate reports on what's happening to kind of collect the data and the information around how this stuff happens and how often it's happening. And that's been really useful data, because over the last 2 years, since October 2023, you know, these systems that have always been in play and really horrific systems, they've really escalated as far as the frequency and the intensity of these attacks, as, you know, as Israeli settlers have seen, you know, oh, we're able to literally get away with what international human rights groups have called genocide in Gaza. What else can we get away with? You know, my friend who was shot dead this year, for the settler who remains free, you know, he looks at it, he's like, I shot someone dead on camera in broad daylight, the world saw it, and I faced no repercussions. What else can I get away with? And so under international impunity, it really has emboldened individual settlers, but also the whole Israeli regime to continue just doing more and more horrific acts. And so the situation in the West Bank is deteriorating so quickly. The entire West Bank is effectively already annexed in practice, but on paper, you know, these are open discussions that Israeli, the Knesset, the government are having about annexing the West Bank. And, you know, just in July last year, countries, including New Zealand, all voted at the UN that Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is illegal and that they need to withdraw within a year. And yet that year has passed and there's been no repercussions, no actual policy shift to uphold these consistent and really brutal violations of international law and human rights. So CPT teams, anyway, play a very important role within that.
I first learned about those about 2004 because Christina Gibbs, who was a Quaker in Dunedin, spent 2 years in Arbon, mostly escorting children to school and back because of the attacks on school children by settlers.
That was something we witnessed as well down in Hebron, actually. Hebron is the largest Palestinian city. And yet when I arrived there last year, within minutes of arriving, we were driving to my friend's house and we had to stop because there were soldiers coming up the street in the middle of the day, turning people around at gunpoint. And then as they left, they fired off two tear gas canisters for good measure. And I was sharing this story last year in Dunedin, and a wonderful community leader there, Dr. Mai Tamimi, she stood up and she said, actually, yeah, I grew up in Hebron, and this happened so often that we would carry a half slice of onion to school with us each day because you kind of, like, you breathe it in as an antidote to this tear gas. And, you know, that's something that she grew up with all the time. And when she said this, I remembered the soldiers in this case, they cleared out of the street and parents arrived and they opened the gate beside where this tear gas had been fired off. And all of these school kids came out of their school that was right there. So, yeah, I mean, the need for protective presence just in order to get to school continues. And I mean, it's so messed up that this is the childhood that people grow up with.
Tell us more about the wall and the effect of the wall on travel and checkpoints. Because many people, I don't know if it's still the case, but it was the case that many Palestinians actually worked inside Israel, including in hospitals and universities, but they had to go through checkpoints to get to work and back, or get, or if they had health problems, to get to a hospital and back. Can you talk about this?
So the wall was built in the kind of early 2000s, and in 2002, the International Court of Justice, the highest court of the UN, ruled that these walls are illegal, again, because 85% of it is built inside the West Bank, creating this situation of de facto annexation. One example being, just north of Bethlehem, there is a large group of olive groves, and then there's the wall, and then there's Bethlehem. But the owners of these olive groves live in Bethlehem. So what was once a 5-minute journey to go and farm their trees and their land suddenly becomes an hour and a half journey through these checkpoints, if they even are able to get the correct permits in order to get through the checkpoints. Often these permits are incredibly hard or impossible to get. And they need to get through. They need to farm their land, because if they don't farm their land, then after 3 years under Israeli law, it becomes wasteland. And this is a law, a legal pretext that then shifts the ownership to the government. And so, similar to our history here in Aotearoa, you see these laws that are written into being to transfer the ownership of land from these indigenous communities who have farmed it and stewarded it for generations, for millennia, to the state. And then often it's again gifted to settlements for the establishment of these Jewish-only townships. So that's one example of the wall kind of annexing land and restricting access to people. But as you've touched on, there were many, before October 2023, there were many Palestinians actually working inside of Israel. And this is one of the things that often kind of gets used, like, you know, Israel was being so generous, letting them work there. Why did they, you know, why is there this kind of hostility towards Israel when they're being so generous? Many of these communities, their homes, their villages remain inside of Israel, and they cannot return. They cannot rebuild there. The reason that they are working inside of Israel is because the occupation has crippled the economy within the West Bank and within Gaza. I think unemployment in Gaza was at around 70% or higher prior to October 2023. And so with that comes poverty. It becomes very difficult to get food, to get work. And when you're sitting in that space, there's despair and there's anger. And it's very similar in the West Bank, particularly at the moment. You know, there's no tourists. And so for a place like Bethlehem, where 80% of the jobs depend on tourism, there's huge unemployment. And so that despair grows, poverty grows, and life is very difficult. And so, yeah, many people were working within Israel or even within the settlements. The joke among Palestinians, as a kind of dark joke, is that the settlements and the wall and all of these, the mechanisms of the Israeli occupation, they were built by Palestinians. They were built by construction workers who just needed work in order to get by, in order to feed their families. And so they've almost had to build their own cage. They've built their own way into captivity out of necessity to have work. And again, the final thing with these checkpoints and with the wall, as you touched on, is access to healthcare. There are over 200, I think, no, two, oh, I can't, it's either 200 or 800, I think, barriers across the West Bank. Roadblocks, checkpoints that restrict movement, and the entire West Bank can be shut down within 50 minutes. The Israeli military can shut it all down, isolating towns from one another. And so that then creates, you know, it's difficult to then access water and food if you don't have access to that within your village, and healthcare. You know, a friend of my mate James, who lived down in Hebron, died a few years ago when he had tear gas fired into his house by Israeli forces, and it triggered a heart attack. And they called the ambulance, and the ambulance came, and it was one side of the checkpoint. He was on the other, and the soldiers wouldn't allow either of them through. And so within about 10 meters of the ambulance, he died. And there's stories of this again and again and again, where, you know, pregnant women need to get to hospital, and they're held for hours at the checkpoints, and it causes miscarriages or deaths of the mothers as well. This has been going on for decades, and it's done very intentionally. Just yesterday, I met a lovely Palestinian family in the city that I was sharing some of these stories. And they, you know, they had friends who, one of them in Gaza had cancer. And the hospital he needed to get treatment at was in the West Bank. But of course, to move between them, he needed permits from Israel. And they denied these permits intentionally to prevent him. You know, they just delayed these permits long enough that he passed away from cancer instead of getting to the West Bank, where everything was set up for him to be able to get this very necessary treatment. So it's just cruel. It's really cruel, really quite sadistic mechanisms and legalities. The system is designed for exactly this purpose, to displace and to destroy Palestinian communities.
It's really ironic to me that the Jewish people in Israel will build walls because of their own history. For, you know, for a couple thousand years, they were walled into ghettos and cities. And they had to live with walls and be restricted walls. And in Warsaw, there was a huge wall around the ghetto, and 99% of the Jews in that ghetto were died in Auschwitz or one of the other camps. So for Jews, walls meant death. And yet they were able somehow to build walls. It's almost unbelievable and heartbreaking that they would build walls.
I think that's one of the things as well that we grapple with within this space is the horror of the Holocaust, where over 6 million Jews were slaughtered, was a crime of European anti-Semitism. And in response to the guilt of that, a lot of international nations, their kind of solution has been at the expense of Palestinians who had nothing to do with the Holocaust. But again, that's one of the things that has fueled this. You know, when you face violence, you know, we talk about in schools, the bullied becomes the bully. The victim becomes often the aggressor. And so the trauma of the Holocaust has been weaponized by those in power to actually fuel the militarization of Israel. The creation of Israel as a state was kind of built on this idea of Jews will not be safe in the world unless they have their own state. But they established that state in someone else's state, and it came with the forced expulsion and at the expense of Palestinian communities. But that's probably the biggest struggle for a lot of Israeli communities and Jewish communities around the world. They are told that Israel is essential for their safety, that they have an exclusive right to the land, that all of those around them, you know, hate Israel because it's a Jewish nation, because they hate the Jews. But actually, the reality is Palestinians hate it because it's been established in their homes and in their land and at their expense. Almost everyone I met, you know, clarified, we have nothing against the Jews. We lived alongside them. Many of them were our friends, our families, our business partners prior to the creation of Israel. But this betrayal Yeah, has fed into that. And so there's a fantastic documentary called Israelism about young Jews around the world standing up and saying, no, not in our name, like this does not represent us, and doing the really gritty work of trying to kind of disentangle Judaism from Zionism. Judaism is this faith of love and peace and justice, whereas Zionism is this political ideology, which actually began as a secular political ideology. And that's the driving force behind these crimes that Israel are committing.
Zionism as practice could destroy Judaism as an ethical religion. As Christian nationalism in Germany and America is so harmful to Christianity, ethics, and morality.
Yeah, hugely. When you compare religion and nationalism, it's so violent.
Good news, not so much good news for the West Bank, though in the long run it can be. A social democrat who is Islamic became mayor of New York, with most of the Jews in New York voting for him.
Yeah. So I think Zohran Mamdani,
the attitude of young Jewish people may be changing.
Yeah, and that was a really wonderful thing I got to encounter as well, as these young Jewish community, and old as well, but predominantly young Jewish communities who are the ones on the front lines of peace building. They're working alongside Palestinians in the West Bank, not just out of kind of dialogue. You know, you can't dialogue your way out of these systems. You actually have to confront the systems. And that's what these Jewish communities are doing. And they all emphasized, you know, the work we're doing is barely stemming the flow. You know, we need international accountability, and then our work can actually start to mean something. But until Israel are actually forced to come to the table with genuine intentions, you know, we need the international community behind us, kind of thing. And yeah.
How has Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank, particularly Gaza, affected international law and the rules of law? And why has the UN been so ineffective in relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And what should happen to enable the UN to be more effective?
Yeah. Firstly, I think the framework of international law is an inherently good and very important thing. You know, it is designed on paper to protect the human rights and dignity of every single person. We're talking about equality, you know, the basics.
You're talking about the right to life in many cases.
Yeah. And it has been hugely undermined. Over the last 2 years, seeing what we're seeing happening in Gaza, the atrocities being committed, the muddying of the water, you know, looking at it from a purely legalistic point of view, like forget about the moral point of view, which is just a complete moral outrage that these crimes and atrocities are committed. But from a purely legal point of view, there have been so many facets of international law and humanitarian law just brazenly broken by Israel, and it's just systemic and indiscriminate bombardment and slaughter of communities in Gaza. So, you know, somewhere we're talking now somewhere between 70,000 to upwards of 600,000 people killed. And where it sits within that is very unclear because of the widespread scale of destruction. And I think it becomes particularly important for a little country like Aotearoa. You know, we depend on international law. That's what provides us safety and protection. And so it's been really disappointing to see that there has not been a significant policy shift in regards to our attitude with Israel. You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, within weeks, we put sanctions, sweeping sanctions in place, really strong and adequate action. We didn't just condemn it in words, but we actually condemned it in action. And it's not condemnation. It's not just punishment. It's actually like it's accountability. Often, you know, people talk about boycotts, sanctions, divestment as this really kind of fringe radical thing. It's not. It's actually the most effective pathways of non-violence which we have at our disposal as the international community. And if we want to avoid violence, we actually need to support these pathways of non-violence. I've often said, you know, if we faced the same violence and injustice and horror that Palestinians have faced for decades, and were met with the same indifference from the international community that they have been met with, you would see movements exactly like Hamas form here in New Zealand and gain far wider traction. I mean, I've been blown away by the number of Palestinians who still hold so staunchly to nonviolence in the face of such violence. And international law is a key pillar of that. So it's been hugely undermined by nations not actually holding Israel to account with these jarring double standards. We will we'll sanction Russia, we'll sanction Iran, and yet we won't sanction Israel. When actually that's where the sanctions can be most effective. You know, we're allied with all the countries that are sending the weaponry and the funding and the systems that are used to perpetrate these atrocities. And so when little old Aotearoa speaks up, we're not actually that little. We hold really big sway on the global stage for our size. And, you know, in 2023, we were doing $450 million worth of trade with Israel. That's significant. And we need to act. We need to actually see that shift in policy. And we haven't seen that yet from our elected leaders. So that's been really not just disappointing, but really concerning for the future of international law.
Why do you think this is? Is this bowing to Trump? Is it trying to keep on side with the American president, or why?
Yeah, I think there's a big facet of that. I think particularly when it comes to, you know, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Winston Peters, you know, just recently we made the decision not to recognize a Palestinian state. And then the news came out that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, all the advice that Winston Peters was getting was to support the recognition of a Palestinian state, and that actually to not support it would be seen by Israel as an endorsement of its actions. And yet, despite all of the advice pointing in that direction, Winston Peters still decided to do the opposite. And I think, you know, it's not just Winston Peters. There are some very strong Zionist voices within the National Party, within ACT, within New Zealand First, within our current coalition. And there are many who aren't as well. I've been very fortunate to actually meet with some of the backbench MPs who are actually, I think, would be very willing to support something like sanctions if the government actually made space for that. But to do so alone would essentially be throwing away their political career, and none of them are willing to do that. So the more pressure we can put on for our government to actually take adequate actions, the better. But it is, I think it's hugely, you know, we're just trying to stay on side with the US, who are just spiraling under Trump's, I don't even want to call it leadership. I mean, it's just...
Israel's doing in Gaza and the West Bank, particularly Gaza, affect the humanity of all human beings, affect our world culture and what we're willing to do in the future and what we're willing to prevent in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's undermined.
Undermines humanity. Our humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's also, it's manufactured consent for things that should never be acceptable. You know, we look at the news, it's stopped now, but this, you know, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that was there was shooting hundreds of people every day trying to seek food aid. And that just became this normalized part of the headlines. The things that have become acceptable or just, you know, depressing enough, but oh, there's nothing we can do about it. It's really scary what it has done for our humanity and for the humanity of Jewish communities around the world as well. And that's where I think it's important to emphasize this word equality, because that's what we're talking about. And confronting these systems in the West Bank, systems that human rights organizations have named as apartheid and in Gaza as genocide, you know, we've ended up in this dichotomy where you're either pro-Palestine or pro-Israel, but actually we're talking about pro-humanity. Confronting these systems is also what is best for our Jewish communities, because Israel, you know, they're committing these atrocities and saying they're doing it in the name of Judaism. I think that's the single most dangerous thing for Jewish communities around the world today. And so, yeah, I think we need to make that really clear distinction again between Zionism and anti-Zionism as the criticism of Israel and Judaism, which is a religion, as I say, of peace and love and justice. That's a central pillar of it, justice. And we're not seeing that from Israel. It is not representing the Jewish people.
What can we do to make the UN more effective in peacekeeping? And
I think things like international law are only as effective as the international community's willingness to actually uphold international law. And one of the big problems we've seen with the UN on the Security Council in particular is the veto power. The US and Russia, who are two of the like biggest, most unhinged countries at the moment, have this ability to just veto anything. And so we've seen that, you know, all the resolutions that the Security Council have tried to pass that will have actually meant something to end Israel's atrocities, the US just vetoes it. So that needs to change. And that is one of the great things that Winston Peters actually spoke up about at the UN earlier this year, very surprisingly. So yeah, that needs to shift, and then actually needs to be a willingness from countries to to put repercussions in place when nations like Israel are violating international law, not to pick and choose when and where we support international law, depending who we're allied with. Like it's just become this weapon. Complete double standards is really the big problem there. And we, as the people, we hold the power. We have an election coming up next year, and people should vote the way that they feel reflects, you know, what is good for humanity, who is actually going to hold international law equally across the world.
Is the ceasefire doing any good? Is it holding at all? And is
it's the ceasefire is an interesting one. I mean, it's good because there's far less bombardment than there was, but it is not a ceasefire. Israel have killed hundreds during this period where they were not supposed to be bombing. They've still continued bombing. And Gaza, you know, still is not having adequate food and water allowed in. Or humanitarian aid, it's still sitting in ruins and it's not being rebuilt. And again, it's to call it a peace deal, as Trump and these others have, it doesn't address many of the root issues as to why there is not peace. It doesn't address the injustice. And until there is a peace deal that deals with these millions of refugees who have never been allowed to return, until there's a peace deal that addresses the systemic and structural nature of Israel's violence, then there will not be peace. It's not a peace deal. It's just Palestinian submission to a system of displacement, imprisonment, and death.
But the Palestinians aren't going anywhere, and they're not both not able to go anywhere because nobody's welcoming on them in large scale. I mean, are we welcoming Palestinian refugees in the numbers we should? And are we willing to go out of our way to reunite Palestinian families who are divided? Some are still suffering in Gaza or the West Bank. Well, part of their family may be in New Zealand, but the Minister of Immigration has shown no personal care for this, and the system of immigration in New Zealand certainly isn't allowing for families to reunite.
Yeah, so that's been one of the really big campaigns from community and solidarity groups over the last 2 years, has been calling for special humanitarian visas for families in Gaza who have loved ones here in Aotearoa. A similar scheme was set up within weeks for Ukraine and widely supported by the national government. And so again, it's raised this really jarring double standard where they have not supported the same for Gazan communities. And the reason they said was because, no one can actually get out of Gaza. That was the excuse they used. It's issuing false hope, is what they said. And recently we found out that actually they knew that there are ways to get communities out of Gaza. In fact, they have actually gotten some out, and other countries have, but our government still have not, and still haven't created a tailored resettlement scheme to ensure that that happens. And as a result, you know, there have been dozens of people killed in Gaza, family members, of those living here in Aotearoa who have died, who would be alive today if they had been given these visas and the diplomatic assistance to get them out of Gaza. And in that regard, like, I've got to be blunt, there is blood on our government's hand. Their indifference.
That feels like government history repeating itself, because Jews weren't allowed in America or New Zealand in any large numbers.
Yeah.
During the 40s, and I mean, late 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And this is one of the excuses for the creation of Israel was because Jews weren't allowed in large numbers in any of those countries.
Yeah. And that's a big thing that we need to address. You know, there is, again, different between a criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitism. There is, though, genuine anti-Semitism in places in our society, and we need to really address that, because until Jews feel safe, I mean, we've got countries saying, oh, there needs to be an Israeli state for Jews to be safe. What kind of message does that send to Jewish communities living in your country when you say, oh, they can't be safe here? You know, we need to put things in place to actually ensure they are safe here.
The first thing to do is to bring justice and some way of living together in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah. And again, it's far beyond this kind of idea of dialogue. Like, it's not people not seeing eye to eye. It's until the structural violence is dismantled, then that dialogue can happen. Then that peace building can grow. But until the international community steps up, you know, none of that is actually possible.
What more can we do in New Zealand, the average citizen, to stop the violence and support the Palestinian community.
Mm. Well, I think for one, it's encouraging and empowering our elected leaders to do more. They're not doing as much as they can, and there are people within the coalition who would be willing if there was enough widespread support. So we need to keep pushing in that regard. You know, we cannot let our elected leaders off the hook. They have a responsibility, actually obligations under all of these different international conventions to act. Alongside that as well, we all hold voting power with our money. The way we spend our money is a vote for these different systems. We can buy things that feed into systems of destruction, or we can buy things that feed into destructions of construction, of hope. And so that's where a lot of people are supporting the call for boycotts and divestments and sanctions. It's the ways in which we spend our money sends a message. Are we okay doing business as usual with a state while it is committing genocide or upholding a system of apartheid? Or are we actually willing to put our money where our mouths are and not invest into these systems that are harming and slaughtering people?
How can you possibly justify by putting money into Israeli military spending?
Yeah, well, exactly. People justify it because I think a lot of the time, one, people don't actually realize how bad it is on the ground, what it actually equates to. And secondly, I think actually some people do, but they're fine with it. They find it acceptable because there's been such a dehumanization of Palestinians and Arabs and Islam that people find it acceptable. Also, they say, you know, they justify it.
It's hard to get people to accept that money should be used ethically because the main morality in capitalism and our economic system is to make a profit, as big a profit as possible.
And it's inconvenient to do anything otherwise. Like, you have to actually put an effort and you have to kind of go out of your way. But there are ways that we can do that in easy and simple ways. There's
how
information
do you
online about
see
that.
The possible future of Palestine and Israel?
I hold hope. Although it's very hard to find hope when you look at the reality on the ground. But I think this is why I wish New Zealand was more involved and would speak up louder, because we actually hold hope. You know, I think New Zealand provides, we've got so much further to go, but we provide a really compelling model of what reconciliation and reparations can look like. You know, putting structural systems in place like the Waitangi Tribunal to actually address historic injustices and ongoing injustices. And that's one of the reasons I wish we were louder and more outspoken. I think it provides hope to those on the ground. The same with South Africa. You know, there's fantastic examples like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which, you know, were imperfect, but provided a really compelling step forward out of the systems of apartheid in South Africa. So I do think that there's hope. And I think, though, you know, again, none of those things can happen without the world stepping up. You know, these extremes, these fundamentalists within Israeli society, although they are extreme, they're not fringe. A lot of these extremes hold very strong sway within Israeli government and society. In fact, there was a recent poll by Penn State University that 78% of Jewish Israelis support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. 78%. So these are not fringe perspectives, and they're not going to change until the world actually, you know, isolates Israel the same way we isolated South Africa and other countries throughout history, to say we're not willing to do business as usual until you actually address this problem and give equal rights to everyone in the land. And until there is equal rights, you know, there will not be peace, because people are living under a system of domination, displacement, imprisonment and slaughter.
So those would be your hopes.
Well, this is probably a bit of a darker tone to end on, isn't it? But no, my hope, I think, sits in action. It sits in what people are doing. I think we often talk about hope as just kind of wishful thinking, but actually hope is gritty action. You know, hope is embodied in what we do with our hands and feet, and, you know, in the things that the actions we take, the response we have. I always talk about, you know, say the top of my head is where things should be, but the bottom of my feet are where things are, then everything in between is empty space that can be filled with hope with our actions. And I think, you know, if you're feeling hopeless, channel that anger and despair into something, anything meaningful. And it tops up that tank a little closer until we reach, you know, justice, reconciliation at the top when things are as they should be. So I think, you know, we embody hope with our actions, and we embody that in a way that Palestinians currently cannot. We hold far more power over what happens in their land than they can a lot of the time. So We can support them and the Jewish communities working alongside them by doing what we can here in Aotearoa and across the world.
Okay, thank you very much, Cole, for being willing to talk about this and for your work on the West Bank and hopefully future work as a journalist.
Thanks, Marvin. No, it's been a real privilege to share these stories, and I know it means a lot for my friends on the ground to feel heard, and so it means a lot for me as their friend as well to know that they are heard. So, yeah, thank you.
We've been talking with Cole Martin, a journalist who's spent 6 months on the West Bank in Palestine, talking about the condition of both the Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, and what the obligations we have to change what's happening, to make meaningful protests and meaningful economic and political actions to change the present and the future for better. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Martin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.